Welcome back. It's so good to be back with you guys. It's been a minute.
Well, it's been a week to be exact.
I know, but we haven't had guests on in so long that it feels like it's like been an extended break. I feel like maybe we've spent some time apart to grow closer together.
I don't think that's it either, because we record every week, so it doesn't really impact us like that. But I guess we are getting closer to the end of this season, so that's fun.
Yeah, we are. I think we only got like three episodes together left after this, and then we're done.
Damn.
You don't have to look at my face anymore.
Yes.
Vacation.
So today we're going to start to like move the needle forward a little bit. We've spent a lot of time talking about the early 20th century at this point, right? And like all these different pieces that built into like the slingshot of the permanent agriculture movement, mostly from the early 20th century to like the mid 20th century to about World War II, right? And then we saw like the government like invest in agriculture for like how we know agriculture today, right? Now, in the last episodes that we did together, we talked a bit about like Russell Lord trying to like bridge these like interest areas of ecology and agriculture and permanent agriculture movement or the permanent agriculture movement, try to keep it from like falling into like this pseudoscience or like kind of cultish space that wasn't really engaged with the rest of like agriculture.
So now is the time we're going to start getting into stuff most people are familiar with. And by most people, I mean like the 24 of our listeners who know what we're talking about at any given time.
Yeah, those people. All of you guys.
Two dozen.
There are dozens of us. all right. So the divisions in this movement start with like a handful of folks. And we're gonna talk about two of them today. And that's Eugene and Howard Odum, or Howard T. Odum. Now, they're the sons of a sociologist named Howard Washington Odum and his wife, Anna Louise Krantz. Howard Washington was very similar to his sons, except instead of ecology, he was interested in sociology. He played a major role in American history around how we understand sociology, where he focused largely on the development of this idea of like regionalism in the American South. Now, much like the permanent agriculture movement's leaders, Howard W., the father, really tried to like bridge these gaps between various fields of study to create like a comprehensive, all-inclusive understanding of Southern identity. And his goal was really to like show unity through diversity, even if like his understanding of race and class were, let's say, poorly understood.
This is going to be another case where he probably used the N-word a lot.
Oh, Lord.
I cannot confirm nor deny.
I say probably.
Ye says yay. Yeah, he was obsessed with this idea of like identity and how it related to like this idea of like folkways with like technic ways, which was his idea of like technology and how it integrated into our lives, and stateways and the way that like the state organized people and technology and the way that they lived their lives, right? So how do all these different things kind of tie together? You know, technology, intellectualism, identity, specialization, centralization, and basically the government. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because his big concern was this idea of the achievement lag. When he explained it, he said, in quote, "Man has too often failed to apply his technical skills to prevent the social problems that have been created by the rapid expansion of technology," end quote. Which, you know, I think he might have been onto something there. He would spend his life trying to find a way in which humans could rein in technology to basically try to find a way to address social problems before continuing to develop that technology.
Foreshadowing music.
Bum, bum, bum. I didn't want to plug in my keyboard. I'll do it next time.
I bet Teddy fuck with the Odum family.
It's got Ted energy, yeah. Got big Ted energy. Mm.
You mean like the president or like Ted Talks?
As
oh,
in
no, not the,
finger
the third
remover
option.
3000, which we all know is the best way to address complex problems like how we use technology.
Yes. Industrialism and its consequences.
Yeah.
For those who don't know what we're talking about the one and only Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, which I think we'll do an episode on at some point because he's a really interesting person, whether or not you like him, as well as like how his story ties into this and other movements that became radicalized by deep ecology and stuff like that, which is another.
And MKUltra, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, and MKUltra. That's an Elliot episode right there.
Fuck yeah.
But yeah, so that's a story for another day. Today we're talking about our friends the Odoms. Now, Eugene Odom was born September 17th, 1913, 11 years before his brother Howard on September 1st, 1924. They both were fairly like nerdy, boring people in terms of like their childhood and like their college experience.
Got him.
Eugene studied ornithology and got a doctorate from the University of Illinois in 1939, went to take a faculty position at the University of Georgia in 1940, and spent the rest of his career there.
Whew.
Now, Howard would also take a very equally mundane path, gaining a doctorate in biogeochemistry from Yale in 1951, and he took a position at the University of Florida at Gainesville, where he was for quite a bit.
Well, that was a short episode, and what's with all these guys going to school for ornithology?
Nerds. Now, I have no actual answer for you on that, but in 1954, they both were hired by the Atomic Energy Commission to study a coral reef at the Eniwetok Atoll atomic test bomb site. This is a big deal because when they went to go study this coral reef, they realized that the coral reef itself was what you might consider, or what they considered, a steady state system. And it was basically that the idea that the coral reef system used most of the energy it consumed through photosynthesis, and this allowed it to regulate it. And the idea was that the system was self-maintaining, self-regulating. It didn't release more energy than it brought in. It was static.
So I feel like people already kind of knew about this at the time and called it like climax ecosystem, and that would apply to coral reefs.
Yeah, so that's true. But the idea of the Odom brothers kind of extrapolated from this was that this existed outside of like visible plant communities. So things from like puddles to entire continents still fell into the same, it was just a stacked sizing, that same concept, that same system. And fundamentally for them, this idea of like energy was the common denominator for analyzing any system. And they ended up coming up with this term ecoenergetics, which was basically measuring the energy flow through a system. And the significance of this was, of course, that the energy could be understood and translated into human systems so that when we think about natural world systems, we could measure them similarly to like industrialized systems.
So they invented eco-algebra or like made it a physical science.
What's with these dorks? New algebra? Are you kidding?
Yeah, that is, though, a good way to put it. Now, in comparison to like how ecosystems and ecology and even agriculture were understood, this was like a very big step forward. And it allowed the Odoms to like critique, and again, think about when they were born quite a time back. They were in their early career during FDR's time. And it gave them a lot of tools to like critique things like the Soil Conservation Service that FDR had backed, especially as the Cold War began to ramp up shortly after World War II. And as the Cold War ramped up, the Soil Conservation Service had started to move away from conservation and more towards maximizing food production because they needed to like weaponize food in like the Second World for like proxy wars.
Matt, the reason I know you're a millennial is because you're getting to the age where all you want to do is talk about like war politics.
I mean, the idea of tanks are pretty cool. Maybe not for like war, but I'm thinking of like really cool demolition derbies. Don't know why we don't see more of that on TV.
Elliot just really wants a killdozer. So, you know, if anyone's got a killdozer out there, I know a guy.
Oh my God. Dom, please save us from this domestic extremism references in this episode. I don't want to hear this in court.
Again. And honestly, like in all of this, we haven't really talked about World War II. But if you want, we can back up, Matt. I know it sounds like you're actually a little excited.
Well, as long as we're not going back to the Ice Age.
We can do a World War II episode.
So back when...
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
Wow, that was all really interesting. Now, let's get back to the odoms.
You sounded so enthusiastic. That sounded so genuine, Matt.
Thank you. I've been practicing my genuine voice.
Okay, so
it sounded genuine.
It sounded genuine.
Don't worry, genuine. It wasn't.
After the war, there's this big boom around food production. This was exacerbated by the retooling of chemical production from the war and how that chemical production could be used for fertilizers. And as that American Green Revolution exploded, again, with the Cold War gearing up, we pushed it overseas.
Yeah, like we talked about with Africa.
And Mexico.
And Asia. Yeah, we can go on and on. We covered it in the past.
Most of the continents.
Yeah, most of the world.
Antarctica, I'm looking at you. We're coming.
Yeah.
We're going to.
Climate change 2023.
We're going to revolutionize the tundra there. It's going to be green as fuck.
Get me a fertilizer spreader and get me to Antarctica. I swear to God. I just got to get ammonia on that.
So with this growth, the permanent agriculture movement started to wither pretty much. And this like weird mix of folks from the permanent agriculture continued to like advocate for more ethical systems, from the Back to the Land movement, which we'll be covering shortly, to the Friends of the Land Journal, which was started by our good friend Russell Lord. Now, despite fundamental differences between these groups about the role of homesteading, the concept of scale and technology, the reality is that there weren't enough major players to like justify these being separate movements at the time. So it's just kind of like this weird mashing. And they all fundamentally agreed that like there needed to be some kind of balance between humans and nature. And this idea that like humans are a part of nature and that soil conservation and restoration were kind of this like basis of this philosophy, right? Like whether it's the organic movement, Back to the Land, permanent agriculture, it all was framed in this idea of like soil conservation, keeping the ground healthy, right? Quote unquote healthy. While seemingly similar, the Odoms kind of took a little bit of a different position, and that instead systems didn't need to be necessarily balanced, but rather that human ecosystems simply needed to more closely resemble natural systems.
Okay, so emphasis on resemble and not actually be natural with human influence.
Exactly. And for folks that have been listening to us for a while, understand like our whole thing, that should make your ears kind of perk up, right? And it's pretty foreshadowing
dun, dun, dun.
How this evolves into some of the current positions of alternatives to conventional agriculture. And that's going to play out as this episode goes on. Let's bring up one that's not even really an alternative anymore. So like organics, right? We're going to be talking about organics in a little bit. The biggest barrier to its development as a serious alternative to conventional agriculture at this time was due to its close proximity to like pseudo-medical beliefs and pseudo-scientific beliefs. They believed in, and this is talking about back organics back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, that organic vegetables were inherently better quality and that there were universal benefits of uncooked vegetables. And when I say better quality, I mean like the stuff that you hear about like creepy pills today that like, you won't get cancer if you're eating organic, basically.
The classic soil health to raw foods diet pipeline.
Wait, so there are people that won't cook, they wouldn't cook their food?
Oh yeah, that's a real thing. Those white people have way too much free time. I mean, I know you keep saying that we don't have culture, but you know what? White people found out that cooking food makes it too spicy.
So it sounds like they haven't heard of the wonders, the magical wonders of nixtamalization, which means they haven't listened to our goddamn podcast.
True.
No, they have not. Now, the Odoms, to tie this back to like the important part of this episode, they believe that organic and Back to the Land and all these things, they didn't address the issues facing ecosystems that needed to be addressed. And basically that this idea of like alternative agriculture as it had existed and developed to this point was basically like naive, and the continued growth of like extension schools and the Soil Conservation Service and all these other like things to like help farmers weren't really a sustainable option either. they so strongly believed that both sides were wrong that in their writings about like ecology and like their systems thinking, they basically ignored any contributions that were made by non-ecologists and ignored most, if not all, until later on, contributions by indigenous people to land management techniques. And they really tried to define agroecology, which is how they framed their understanding of the best way to create food systems, within like a really narrow parameters that like really put like capital S science as the only way forward.
So these were like the smart white guy, Bill Gates predecessor type folks who came in with ideas and maybe the ability to move some money around to fix everything, but just everything seems to get worse after.
It's like if you took Elon Musk and you gave him a younger brother and then you made them feed off of each other, is what I'm saying.
Except there was 1930s science mixed in.
Yeah, and like maybe some brains. I'll give them that. Like the Odoms were smart. I will not take that away from them. But they had a severe case of white man syndrome.
Sounds deadly.
It usually is. Yeah, it's terminal. Now, because of this chosen alienation from like most of the alternative agriculture movements, this had like long term ramifications on agroecology and why that movement never made a lot of traction here in the United States. And like for many people listening to this, they probably haven't heard the term very often outside of us. As they were doing this really great job of alienating themselves, and the Dust Bowls of the 1950s kind of rolled through the nation because, you know, why not? It became very obvious again that like farming for profit was really difficult because, you know, fertilizers were expensive and we were growing too much food and we're teaching the rest of the world to grow food. There was just like a lot of things going on. Now, because of their lack of willingness to like try to find common ground with folks that like wanted to do good stuff, agroecology kind of dwindled and organics and biodynamics and the back to the land movements continued to grow.
So there was like the big Dust Bowl in the 30s, right? And then they still were having small pocket Dust Bowls in the 1950s?
We have been basically on the precipice of a Dust Bowl basically since the 20th century started.
Man, that just gives you a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling inside.
Or it makes you want to buy pallets of grain and or water futures.
Pallets of grain is what caused this.
We did an episode on water futures in our Patreon. Remember that?
Yep.
That was your favorite.
That's my nightmare.
A soft plug for a Patreon episode we did like 3 years ago. Now, to speak to their like white guy syndrome, white man syndrome, they fundamentally believed that their jobs as ecologists was to, in quote, manage with actions. And what this meant was they wanted to create human systems based on ecological laws. And part of this was to manage also farmers, because farmers were incapable of understanding ecology and they were basically supposed to just be like the labor of the ecologists who knew better. This was all predicated on that quarrel, right? This idea of like developing mathematical computations that could unify and compare the energy used in any type of food growing. So whether you're talking about grow or anything growing for that matter, whether it's a wheat field or a forest or a prairie.
Okay. So that reminds me of Tom Wessels when he talks about that leveling of complexity. They were trying to take that simple algebraic formula and make it so that ecology could be understood and explained with, you know, simple math. They were flattening out that complexity, that curve of complexity.
To an extent, yeah. They understood the ecological diversity concept and things like that. But as we're going to see, those were just numbers that could be plugged in that were, you know, variables, as opposed to like understanding the system with more depth than that. And we're going to get to that. Now, Eugene's vision was primarily focused on like the big picture. And it was Howard that kind of really built these models.
When you say models, do you mean like farms?
Oh, no, just building models.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah, neither of them actually really had any experience farming. And that kind of comes to bite them in the ass later on. And the idea of these models was basically to show how energy flows through farms and ecosystems and how much energy in systems can be lost. And that energy loss was usually through heat. So like anything you can think of that consumes a lot of energy, the byproduct is heat loss, right? Whether it's a car or anything, right? Friction, heat loss. That's the primary way that energy is lost in a system, is that transfer of energy, which creates heat. Now, what they realized was that they could use circuit diagrams, which, if you're not familiar with circuit diagrams, they're usually used to show electricity. But they felt they would be really good for showing things like positive and negative feedback loops. So now, as the 50s and 60s continued on, they'd finished up with their reef study. They went to go work at the Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory. And while they were there, they won two prizes in ecology from two countries in a few short years, which basically kind of put them on the map as ecologists. Despite their rise to fame, they still really focus on this idea of like diagrams and how they would help develop models for what future agroecological systems would look like. Now, for context, way back last year, we did an episode on Erna Bennett. This is the same time she was coining the term genetic erosion. And like this idea of like addressing the shortfalls of conventional agriculture from like a much more, I guess, creative perspective. I'm not sure what the term would be, but from like a very much different perspective than like it's less energy efficient. But no, this diversity is important for diversity's sake and for, you know, regional diversity's sake. Now, people listening can't see it, but I did include for these guys a example of one of those energy circuit diagrams. And Elliot, what does that look like to you?
That one time I tried to wire my motorcycle and realized I was in over my head.
Yeah, that's about right.
Hmm.
Did you learn that in biology, Matt?
No, we didn't see any of this. But like arrow coming out of cattle, milk, blood, meat.
Science, Matt.
Yeah, it's a flowchart.
Yeah,
it's a flowchart.
Pretty interesting. I guess it'd take kind of a while.
Which I could read, but when you say circuit to me has like a bit of a cycle to it. I mean, that's what circuit means to me.
Yeah, I mean, it does. And then you have the sun, which is like the electricity going in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the heat loss.
Oh my God.
Sun energy. And then it's just got some numbers with no units. So I don't know what the hell that is. But it says, what is that? 1.5 million? 1.5 million sun energy units.
Mm.
And that gives you 1,000 crops. This is like the rules to civilization. What is this?
Hell yeah.
I'm talking about the game, Sid Meier's Civilization. That's what this sounds like to me.
Man, it does. It looks like, I know what you're talking about. It kind of looks like the technology discovery chart.
Yes.
Yeah. Man. But you're right about like the loop thing. And I think that's, I think we've kind of cracked it here, is we just need to start sending energy back to the sun.
That is the hack.
Yeah.
Infinite energy hack.
We got to get a big light.
We got to start sending nukes. Like, why are you sending light? Just fucking nuke the sun.
All energy is renewable. We just have to send it back.
Yeah. When it's nighttime, we can get a big flashlight, reflect it off the moon back at the sun. Oh my God. Okay.
I can just feel our Nobel Prize coming.
I know we have more to cover, but like looking at these diagrams and like what the brothers Odum were talking about, it seems very like sanitized. I understand like using a common energy unit, but it doesn't really fit. Like based on what we've talked about before, it doesn't really fit into the complex systems that underscore agroecology like nowadays.
And that's what I was saying earlier about, I know they were oversimplifying it, but I don't know how you quantify or qualify all of the variables that go into the complexity of an ecosystem.
Right.
Yeah. And I think we're going to address some of that feeling in a minute. And really what underscored their analysis was this idea of like how the laws of energy defined how effective different agricultural methods were. And it wasn't as precise as I think we would expect it to be, but it was like a tool to help us have like a broad strokes conversation. So the first two laws we've discussed around this idea of complex system science in the first episode, you know, way back 4 years ago, these laws define that all energy is accounted for and that energy degradation creates entropy. And that's done usually through heat sinks, as I pointed out a little earlier. The final law, and this is still up for debate as an official law in our understanding of energy flow, which is the Darwin-Lotka law or the maximum power principle.
So this is something you talked with David Holmgren about last summer, right?
Exactly. So the basic principle of this law is that natural selection selects for maximum effectiveness in the use of available resources. For example, that sounds simple, but it's not what you probably think. The idea is that the plants that can survive with the least amount of rainfall take over dry regions. It's this methodology that underscores the vision that HomeGrid and, to a lesser extent, Mollison put into permaculture. And we're going to talk about that in a few weeks, but this is like kind of the preamble to that episode. Now, the Odoms framed their work around what they had learned about mature ecosystems, that they tended to have production equal to respiration or energy loss. This meant that the maximum power system eventually created stability within an ecosystem due to increased efficiencies. In many ways, the maximum power principle can be understood as the mathematical framework behind natural selection. And as natural selection refines species diversity and conversely efficiency within an ecosystem, fewer species risk extinction because they've evolved specifically for those specific conditions, right?
Sure. I mean, it sounds way oversimplified because they're taking that formulaic expression of an ecosystem and changing it one variable at a time and stating that the equation will balance itself out.
Yeah, and the thing is, when we talk about maximum effectiveness in the use of available resources, it's not the most efficiency for a specific thing. It's the most efficiency for that diverse set of conditions.
Okay.
So like you think about like New England, right? The things that live here aren't the thing that lives the best in 70 degrees only, right? It's the thing that can live in 70 degrees and 0 degrees most effectively, right? It's not negative 20 to 40 degrees. It's in that band that is most consistent here, right? Think of it like a transmission. Where do you get your best efficiency? It's within a specific band of your transmission. It's that same concept. It's not about a very specific speed at a very specific height or anything like that, right? It's about that broad strokes. Here are the most common conditions for that gear. So that's where it's most effective or most efficient.
It gives it a Goldilocks zone. That's where that steady state comes from.
Exactly. So it's that Goldilocks zone that thing has co-evolved to be maximally productive. And that gets misunderstood, as we're going to talk about. But what they were able to do with this understanding of the maximum power principle and their schematics, they were able to take their knowledge and understanding of how ecosystems' energy worked and used it to criticize the Green Revolution. Their vision was, you know, as they watched the Green Revolution take off, they believed the American agricultural system was the most inefficient. And they argued that the reason why people thought the Green Revolution was so successful was based on what they called energetic fallacies, and that there would be eventually a long-term cost for all those short-term increases in productivity from like petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides.
Okay, so they were ahead of the curve on that one.
Yeah, and they basically from the 60s on, they screamed the sky was falling. As the sky didn't fall, painted them as kind of weirdos and eccentrics.
Just birds fell out of the sky.
They were waiting, yeah.
Good at math, bad at predictions, probably shouldn't gamble.
Were the birds real then?
They were. And now they're not, Elliot. Do with that as you wish.
If they were falling out of the sky, then they were right.
If Ted only knew. Speaking of gambling, though, go gamble all your money and then buy whatever it is that is in this ad.
That's not fear-based marketing at all.
No, never.
Hey there, it's me, Crazy Norm, down at Normal Norm's Nut Emporium on John Brown Drive. We're going nuts for nuts in Nutty November. We've got big nuts, small nuts, chestnuts, ground nuts, nut butter, buttery nuts, nut milk, milky nuts, nut cream, creamy nuts, and for the late-night crowd, chocolate-covered CBD, deep-fried nuts. Want to join the nut extravaganza? Nut up and join the nut posse. Join other members and get your sack of nuts pounded for free whenever you come in and make the creamiest nut milk you've ever had in your own kitchen. Crazy Norm's Nut Emporium, 420 John Brown Drive or online at fourproles.com.
All right, so fortunately for the Odoms, developments in like technologies such as computers and calculators made it much more easy for them to try to fully account. Like, you know, we pointed to the fact that the math and a lot of those early graphs were very simple. But having these tools available allowed them to start better accounting for the costs of or the energetic costs for fossil fuels used in like massive crop yields. And their argument was that it didn't matter what the gross energy produced by farms was, like thinking about like a yield, right? That's the measurement that we use to say whether or not a farm is successful. What was their yield? Who had the biggest yield, right? But their argument was, you know, what was the net energy of that farming system? So what had to go in versus what came out? In this process, their studies, they found that hunting and gathering and subsistence farmers showed small net yields, while highly industrialized farming tended to have a net energy loss. And there was a strong correlation between adding energy inputs like fertilizer and having decreased net yields.
So what you're saying is that, like, math is radicalizing these guys into being anti-civ. And I'm not talking about anti-civ mere Civilization 5, the other one.
the TED one.
The big one.
Yeah, there's... We should be doing a lot of TED jokes in this, and we're really not carrying our weight on this one.
Walking
it's a good
line.
Thing he's dead. He would not be impressed with us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're necessarily anti-civ, but they definitely have some pretty hot take solutions, which is going to make everyone who listens to this and is like, yeah, permaculture's not that bad, start to probably feel a little guilty for that. So they believed that we would be at some point returning to like the intensive agricultural systems that we talked about, like, with F.H. King, remember his Farmers of 40 Centuries, that when he was in Asia, and that was the only way we could sustainably survive, is to like kind of go back to this like communal farming or homesteading type system. And as the OPEC oil crisis in 1973 hit, the fears of things like peak oil became like less of a fringe idea and more of like mainstream. And the Odoms believed that this was their moment, this was their time in the sun, that people would turn to them to address, like, what is happening, what do we do? And this idea of, like, eco-energy would be, like, the new way that we structured and understood how to measure society and agroecology. And to an extent, it did. However, it wasn't really who they had hoped to turn to them.
It was Teddy K.
I mean, obviously, from the quaint cabin in rural Montana, there stood a man, Matt. He's inspired by the Odoms and the permanent agriculture movement.
I mean, it makes sense. They're basically saying farming isn't about a bottom line. It's about what goes into it and sort of being, I mean, the term we use today is carbon neutral, but they're trying to bring that shit back. And the thing that's funny about Ted is he was just part of a population of what I like to call early adopters. And whenever they come in, those people...
Early bomb adopters.
Yeah, those people are always crazy.
That is true. But... And the actual folks, I could not. So when I started reading about this, I really wanted to find some proof that Ted was into the Odom brothers, but I could not find anything that ever linked
no,
him
it's
to
all
them.
Weird. It's only weirdos like us that are into the Odom brothers.
I am not into the Odom brothers. I am reporting on the Odom brothers. Uh-huh. So the people who were
I honestly thought this episode was about a blues band.
H.D. Odom.
We're just really switching it up.
Yeah, I was thrown for a loop on this one.
So the folks who were into the Odom brothers were actually like mostly organic farmers and environmentalists. So like the Rodale Institute, which many folks are probably at least familiar with the name today, would lean on the Odom brothers for like science behind some of their beliefs on this idea of like, what does it mean to develop food sheds based on ecologically important agricultural watersheds, which I think we now know as like the bioregionalism, right? This organic movement that the Rodale Institute kind of pushed into the limelight really looked like agroecology and the Odom brothers for like scientific support for like this very homestead agrarian nostalgia, raw food, eco-health kind of movement.
Wait, so the Rodale Institute created food sheds?
So we have so much to talk about with them. It's coming soon.
The list.
So you're going to have to wait. It's near on the list, like maybe next week. Now, from the environmental side, the Howard's energy-based perspective also backed the deep ecology movement of the 1980s. For folks that are unfamiliar with the deep ecology movement, you clearly are not familiar with Bookchin, so I'm happy for you that you haven't gone down that rabbit hole yet. But its framework is really simple. It's that all life on Earth, human and non-human, has intrinsic value, and diversity itself is valuable just in its existence, and that humans don't have the right to reduce this diversity except to survive, and that humans, and this is where it gets a little funky, have interfered with these levels too far already, and that a substantial decrease in human population would both benefit humans and non-humans' ability to thrive.
Yep, that last part definitely sounds like a sci-fi movie.
Yeah, you start to go off the rails, and you're like, oh, we're going off the rails very quickly.
Yeah, it sounded good. I was like, wow, that's the first time anybody's thought that about the differences in humanity. And then it goes right back to, like, we got to get rid of the humans.
Get rid of, like, 75%, just not me.
Immediately. So their very numbers-based understanding of the best way to do things, it seems like, I don't know, it seems like they wanted, like, an AI or, like, hive mind run global government ecosystem, but, like, the tech wasn't there yet.
Yeah, kind of. We're going to get there. Now, I don't really want to get too tied up in deep ecology and how it's evolved and so on, because I know some people might listening be like, well, actually, blah, 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 you know, we're not doing that. Basically, from a purely ecological perspective, their vision of bringing human ecosystems in alignment with, like, ecological laws was backed by, like, a lot of their contemporaries for a number of years. It just hadn't really gotten a foothold in economic ways. So, for, like, example, in 1974, there was a congressional act that mandated the use of net energy analysis, which is basically what they were talking about, this idea of, like, how is energy being used and what's the net return on it, which seems, even, like, by today, I don't think that could ever pass Congress, which is wild. So, like, they were clearly onto something that people in the right places understood was important. Ecologists tended to stay away from this terminology because it was very anthropocentric, right? Like, it was never about, like, the ecosystem needs. It was like, here's how we grow the most food with the least amount of energy loss. And, you know, what about the things that live there, right? And they found this, like, to ignore the actual needs of ecologies. And as their vision of, like, starvation and returning to manual labor failed to, like, ever happen, even when the sky was falling and the oil crisis happened. Basically, after the oil crisis ended, it gave a lot of these agriculture economists who disagreed with them, like, a really easy opening to, like, criticize them and say they didn't really understand how farms worked at scale, and that their analysis was based on, like, these very sweeping generalizations from data that had no real reflection of how things operated.
And honestly, that sounds like the shoe fits, because they never spent time on an actual farm. They just looked at models.
Yeah, a little bit. Now, another factor that kind of influenced their inability to influence policy was that the Odoms were more interested in understanding agroecology than understanding, like, how and why American agriculture existed as it did. So, like, these agriculture economists were criticizing them for, like, not understanding things. And, like, they didn't do anything about that. This, like, really alienated them from a lot of potential supporters other than, like, the super green eco people that were, like, kind of hippy dippy. And even people that would have otherwise sympathized with the Odoms. So it never, like, engaged with policy the way, like, Rexford Tugwell did with, like, he was able to make a whole fucking town exist to push for, like, the homestead communities that he believed in. I mean, they failed, but he did it.
Good old Sexy Rexy.
Sexy Rexy.
Why do you encourage him, Matt?
Hey, I like Bring Sexy Nexy. Sexy Rexy, sexy Nexy, just as much as the next guy.
That's not at all. That's what I'm saying. Why?
It was coming sooner or later, Elliot. Come on.
Sure. There's no way understanding any of this with context, and I think that's what's bothering me. There was no way for the Odoms. There was no way for them to kind of grasp the understanding of why abstract numbers and measurements without context are inherently based in the way power dynamics exist now in the ecosystem and in politics.
Yeah, so I'm getting very curious about what the actual proposals were.
Yeah, I think you're right, Elliot, that they didn't understand how to contextualize the way things were to try to figure out how to fit their pieces into that puzzle, right? Matt, I'm going to answer your question in a second, but the one thing I do want to talk about that's the most important, that influenced permaculture the most, is this idea of, like, the maximum power principle. So Howard, in particular, had been exploring this concept, starting with, like, his dissertation when he was getting his PhD. And this is based on the work of a couple guys named Alfred Lotka and Ludwig Boltzmann, who had worked separately to develop a framework for what they believed to be the fourth law of thermodynamics. And that's the one I mentioned before, this idea that this concept that helped, like, guide self-organization in open systems through how energy was most efficiently directed, right? This idea, again, we kind of talked about it with, like, gears, right? That if you think of, like, about, like, scalability. Like if you build a factory, it's built based on like how much productivity is the most and least amount you would have to make based on what you expect to sell. It's not always going to be 5,000 units a day. One day it might be 8,000, another day it might be 2,000, but you build within that scale. You don't build something that can produce 50,000 if you're never going to be there. Again, it's not a specific number. It's a diversity that is repeatedly applied and being most efficient at those things, right? When we're talking about maximum power, we're not talking necessarily about maximum efficiency. By the 1970s, Howard in particular had kind of narrowed his interest more closely to like the quality of energy, a term which he coined emergy, which I know is obnoxious. I feel like I'm saying energy with like a stuffy nose.
Yeah, that's a rough one.
Yeah, it's not great. Not good at naming things. Now, he defined this idea of emergy as, in quote, the available energy of one kind, usually solar, that has to be used up directly and indirectly to make a product or service, end quote. The idea is like, how does the primary source of energy for the entire Earth, the sun, that Matt has figured out how to hack, translate into stored energy that can be used more effectively?
It's just about reciprocity. You got to give some back.
It is. This idea of maximum power and emergy helped to explain why any system would dissipate energy already captured to create another form of energy. And in that process, what was lost is heat. So he argued that there's this idea of like energy hierarchies, which basically are created as resources that require more energy to take a longer time to develop, and that these items that require more energy need to have a positive effect on the larger system to justify the energy required for their development.
Okay, so the example that's coming to my mind right now is like nut trees being predominantly late succession in a forest because they take more time to produce more calorically dense foods.
Yeah, so like there's a bigger net return for the system, but there's more upfront cost for it, right? So like speaking like very broad strokes, that's kind of the point, right? That like you've invested a lot of energy into the tree and now you're getting that like dividend back. This concept of emergy also came with what he called emergy morality, which came with 15 guiding points. And this is where we start to see things evolve. And so I'm going to go through this really quickly because there's only a couple that I think are really important to like be like, huh, that's not what I expected. So the first one is seek satisfaction in useful contribution. The second is to help maximize real wealth. The third is to reinforce environmental sources. Fourth is treasure genetic and cultural diversity. Five, adapt to natural hierarchy. Six is to minimize luxury. Seven is to minimize waste. Eight, adapt to system rhythm. Nine, share information. 10, optimize efficiency. 11, circulate materials. 12, circulate money. 13, fit the earth. 14, reproduce only as needed. 15, have faith in self-organization.
I have several questions about that list.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, like, some of that sounds cool, but there's a few that aren't great. Like, adapt to natural hierarchy.
Reproduce only as needed. Or, my favorite, fit the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Fit the earth, Elliot. Yeah, and these question points aren't irregularities. So I did find some former students that had written about some of their experiences with them because they were professors. They had some really interesting things that they would say off the cuff. So like some of his former students talked about Howard's specifically interest and belief that the Americans needed to, in quote, outpopulate, end quote, the Soviet bloc, and that the United States had an imperative to use all energy available first before the rest of the world would have access to it. Because, you know, why not?
It's a rough one.
Yeah, Matt, I wish I could make an audio for Matt's face when I read that. yeah, you want to talk about that, Matt? Go ahead.
No, not really. I feel like we'll cover that, but sorry, that just made me cringe.
It should. Yeah, it should. That's the reason I am telling you this, is I want you to cringe.
God now, damn it, Andy.
In 2006, Howard and his wife Elizabeth wrote what he considered to be his hopes for the future, and it outlined their positions on what needed to be done for society to survive the impending energy descent that he had warned about for, at this point, like 50 years. And again, I just want to reiterate, this is 2006.
Yeah. these guys just became very much a lot less cool.
I mean, it happens when you get white dudes who build models instead of actually doing the work that they like to bloviate about. It generally all leads to fascism. Like, I've seen Mad Max. That's pretty much all it is.
Yeah. Now, in this book, what they call The Prosperous Way Down, which, what a wonderful title. Oh, we see a lot of recurring arguments made by, like, Malthusians that the distribution of birth control is necessary in poorer countries, but, end quote, cannot be the only means for stabilizing or decreasing population, end quote. So, you know, take what you want from the use of the word only means for decreasing population. All of those words are important, I guess. They argue that cities must depopulate to locally supported levels without the aid of fossil fuels, and that the Odoms, which is not necessarily like a bad point, I'm trying to be unbiased here. The Odoms also argue that this can only be done, and here's where we go off the rails again, in quote, when the government of cities and counties be combined so they are managed as a single system, end quote, which, you know, fascism. Further, automobiles and fossil fuel reliance must decline, and a focus should be placed on things like increasing the efficiency of already existing infrastructure instead of attempting to scrap and rebuild or rely on future renewable energy policies. Looking at you, 2024.
I feel like this is, like, if they were a baseball player, they'd hit, like, only home runs and strike out the rest of the time. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, and, like, again, the reason why I wanted to do this episode in particular is because this is, as we're going to talk about in a few weeks, this was the inspiration for permaculture. So, like, this is your framework. This is your foundation. And it also points to why agroecology is what it is today in the United States and where we see these overlaps between fascism and, like, green fascism, right? Like, why is green fascism a thing that, like, leaks into all these different movements, and how has it gotten there, and how do we understand this relationship, right? This is all tied together, but you have to understand the pieces that were there to, like, that provided the fertile soil for those movements to grow in the United States. But to, like, that point, like, the vision of the Odoms is, like, a very much like a paradox, right? That's this idea of, like, global information sharing can save us from, like, ourselves. But that same they talk later on that, like, the same information that they want to share across the world to make sure everyone is safe is energy dense. And, like, the internet and storage is, like, very energy intensive. And to offset that, the only people that should have access to information are universities. And they should be the ones that carry the weight of deciding what information is worth saving and what isn't.
So, again, relying on some kind of pure arbiter of fact / choke point and their make-believe system and, you know, deciding what's important there.
Yeah, and, like, for Howard, he firmly believed that he was the arbiter of objective fact. So, for instance, arguing, for example, that there's more power from hydroelectric dams than, like, the value of, like, salmon runs that would exist in those same places. So, like, the objective decision was to say, fuck those salmon, which, you know, yeah.
Jeez, hard disagree.
I know some fish that would have a word or two to say with him. So the Odoms, Howard and Elizabeth, they wrap up their little book essay thing with, like, a critique of capitalism that doesn't, like, toss aside capitalism, but rather argues that capitalism with, like, a decrease in unearned income and more accountability, what they call, end quote, private enterprise with public control. And they suggest that we find new ways to, like, organize families in a world with fewer children. Now, my point here, there's a few points. Like I said, I wanted to bring this up because of permaculture, right-wing fascism, and ecology and their relationship, but also to, like, highlight the complexities in these arguments and that, like, oftentimes, as we've pointed out, objectivity without historical context very often opens up this, like, very dangerous can of worms that can, like, lead to people believing really terrible things.
Yeah, just ask any Black person.
Without historical context, how do we address who has more right to childbearing? How do we decide which communities, like, resources or how those resources are allocated, right? The lack of historical context is what drives the maximum power principle, which justifies the argument that invasives are the best at converting energy or sunlight into energy. That is literally the basis of that argument, is the maximum power principle. That is why invasives have taken over a lot of permaculture. It's this idea of like applying it without any context. And it's like the only arbiter of like what is right or what is objectively true is the person colonizing, right? Or is like the objective person of power. But yeah, it's a complex subject, and it's hard to fully grasp these ideas without any historical understanding. And that is how their framework is done. It's the numbers and the numbers alone without any context. And basically because of their, I guess you could say, like, because of their ego, they really block themselves from actually making a difference outside of like academic settings. But like, despite all their shortfalls, there is still like a lot we can learn from their work, and that like their tools are things that we can use as long as we learn to consider the context of their application, the history of their application, right? To like try to integrate like ecological ethics into like the agriculture that they envisioned in the future.
Yeah, I think my two takeaways from this are pretty good. I'm definitely going to take a look at that 15 rules of emergy morality. I'm going to definitely take a look at that, because I think there's a basis for a good sci-fi movie that sort of mixes between like Blade Runner and Soylent Green. Mm-hmm. Totally like smash those together and make a movie about that. So I'm going to start writing on that, maybe pass it over to Netflix, see what happens. And then the last thing is just, you know, history has proven time and time again to just never trust white dudes who claim to be objective and don't ever prove their objectivity. They just keep harping on the same thing that they came up with because it's going to get them somewhere.
True words have never been spoken.
Yeah, who's the arbiter of facts now, bitch?
All right, so where are we going next week?
So next week, either organics or biodynamics. I haven't decided yet, but both of them are going to be real fun. People have been asking for us to talk about biodynamics for a while, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. But the organics one I'm excited about because I don't think people understand the history of organics. If you can't wait, hop on Patreon, poorpearls.com. Go get a early access, listen to whichever one we drop, because if you're listening to this, then that other one's probably already up.
Yeah, I don't understand organics at all. I thought it was just growing food without fertilizer.
Yeah, it's about to learn a thing.
There's more to it than that.
So much more. You ready for this, man?
Gotta have organic water, man.
Oh God, what are you doing?
Free range water. You ready?
No.
I'm just going to start screenshotting your face when I talk to you sometimes.
Free range, grass fed, carbon neutral water. That's going to be, I'm selling it, man. I'm selling
carbon neutral water.
Grass fed.
C0. Mm-hmm.
You just got to, you just
get that C0.
You literally just have to use the buzzwords. Nobody reads labels anymore. Just got to get them on
like
there.
H2O.
Regenerative bottled carbon water.
Regenerative single use bottled water.
That's what I water my crops with, is Fiji water. Yes.
it helps give them all their essential micronutrients, mm-hmm, so that they can be beautiful little sprouts of lava.
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to stop recording.